Tim Farnsworth has it all, an attractive wife, a lovely home, and a partnership at a prestigious Manhattan law firm, a life anyone would envy. And then one day he's afflicted by a strange disease and finds himself compelled to walk until he drops. Joshua Ferris's much-awaited second novel, The Unnamed, is the story of a man beset by an unrecognized condition he can't control. It's published by the Reagan Arthur imprint at Little Brown, and I'm very pleased that it brings Joshua Ferris to our show today. Hi.
Hi, Leonard.
It must be scary to write a second novel after your first, Then We Came to the End, was such a success.
Well, I had about 100 pages of the second novel written before the first book came out, so I kind of had a buffer of comfort.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of writers actually complain that they then have to go out and promote the book when their mind is somewhere else on their second
book. Yeah, it's a juggling act, but it was, you know, it was fun. It was a great year when Then We Came to the End came out, and I also had, when I had nothing else going on, I had a book to return to. So,
were you concerned that this novel is so different in tone and in content to the first one?
That excited me. More than it concerned me. I think that if I had set out to repeat myself, I would have grown bored, and I suspect the reader would have grown bored.
Well, although Janet Maslin sounded like she was expecting another funny book.
She had expectations that I didn't meet, and I forgive her for that.
Well, that is a problem when a critic has an idea of what a book should be, and you've written something else. I mean, do you feel that they should be... Well, obviously you must feel that they should review the book at hand, not the one that they thought you should have written.
I think that maybe that's even expecting too much of a critic. I mean, I think that, you know, you bring the whole baggage into the review when you do it. But I do think that it's extremely important to take the work at hand for what it is and do your best to be fair to it. I don't know that was a terribly fair review, but I could be biased. However, being biased doesn't mean you're not wrong.
As the author
not
of the
right.
book. Do you think a disease or a condition would be more terrifying if it can't be named or categorized?
I certainly think so. I mean, I think that when somebody is struck down by something that they don't understand, one great source of solace, I don't know if it really answers the question, but one great source of solace is to have the name of it, whether it can be cured or not, whether it can be even treated. To know what it is seems almost essential when you're suffering.
Because even then, there'll be some hope, because somewhere down the line, somebody might be able to come up with a cure.
I think there's that. There's the sort of outstanding hope that someone will cure it.
And he might feel less alone.
I think that there's that. The fact that he might not be the only one. I mean, one of the very fascinating things I think about the internet is that it brings people who suffer from rare diseases or even, you know, very familiar diseases together, and they feel less alone when they're together in a format like the internet provides. It's why they have support groups, you know, that pre-exist the internet. And so I think if Tim had found a name for his disease, he might have found a fellow sufferer, and that would have sort of alleviated some of the existential loneliness that he feels throughout the book.
And then we also have a kind of fantasy that perfect health is the norm, and any experience other than that is to be shunned or denied. And for men, perhaps even more than women.
That's true, and certainly for a man of his station, because he's a successful professional and he prides himself on his professionalism. It reminds me of a quote that I kept coming back to when I was writing the book. It's a quote by Kierkegaard, who said that the physician knows that just as there can be merely imagined illness, so too can there be merely imagined health. I find that very compelling, because I think that most of us have probably the illusion that we're going along doing pretty well until we're struck down by something. And most of us also have something peculiar that goes on with us as well, that we complain about to our spouses or to ourselves, that can't really be denied.
But that quote mentions imagined illness. Is this a different book if the cause is psychological rather than physiological?
It's maybe not a different book, but it perhaps is a different way. It would be a different way for him to see his illness. I mean, it's very important for him in the early pages to find out whether or not it's a mental or a physical disease, as I think it is for many people when they're suffering from something that falls through the medical cracks. But ultimately, I don't think it matters to him. I mean, it's something that takes his life over, and whether or not it's caused at an organic level or some kind of mental psychosis, it doesn't matter in the end.
When you meet readers of the book, do they ask you what to diagnose him?
I have been asked that, but I think what is most important is that this book be read as a book about a disease and not necessarily about a book that answers what causes disease or as an allegory or as a metaphor. I think, you know, you can sort of look and at the end of the book make guesses at what it might be a metaphor for. But it is first and foremost a very flesh and blood story about a man who is suffering from something that he simply cannot get a diagnosis of and certainly not a cure for.
The novel starts dark with a description of the cruelest winter, and you say that cold was the mother of invention, a vengeful mother whose lessons were delivered at the end of
a lash.
Yeah. A whip lash, right?
Yeah.
Now, is that a thematic statement that you're making there?
Well, I was doing my best to construct a fictional world that used weather in a very severe way, because he is exposed to the elements when he is walking. You know, he's walking outdoors, and at a certain point, about three-fourths of the way through the novel, he is never to return indoors again. And so the fictional world imposes severe elements upon him. It makes his trial a little harder, I think.
Although some people see suffering as ennobling.
I think he arrives at that point. It's a difficult task for anyone because it doesn't just happen. You know, you don't just get sick and then all of a sudden you're like, well, I'm noble now, thank God. I think that it's a process, and that process, you have to actually fall many rungs below noble before you can achieve a certain peace with it and rise to the occasion. And I think that is precisely the route that he takes.
My guest is Joshua Ferris, whose latest novel, his second novel, is The Unnamed. It's published by the Regan Arthur imprint at Little Brown, the new imprint there, named after Regan Arthur. The unnamed disease or condition that manifests at the beginning of the book is a recurrence. Hadn't you originally started the book with Tim experiencing it for the first time and trying to figure it out?
That's right. I had this image in my mind of a man who was, you know, doing well. He was a lawyer, and I thought it would be interesting to sort of rip him from the urinal and have him force him to buckle up while in the hallway of his law firm. And I just sort of liked the image of that, because, you know, men tend to do that even unthinkingly. It's sort of a trope at work where you're walking down the hallway and find somebody doing something they probably should have finished up in the bathroom. But he was doing it without any freedom of his own will. I mean, he had to do it because he was being forced to walk. It didn't work. It was the wrong place to start the novel. So I started it later on when the disease has recurred and everybody sort of goes into emergency mode, and slowly the reader gets the sense of exactly what the contours of the disease are.
Well, like all people, he's in the middle of a complicated life when this recurrence takes place. He's right. Middle-aged, dealing with a difficult teenager, but he's also at a good point in his career, isn't he?
He is. I mean, he's a partner at a law firm. He's wealthy. He's happily married after a good number of years. And he defies some of the types of personality that I have met in the law field here in New York, who fit the mold of a successful professional a little bit better. I think he defies that a little bit.
Well, this could be called a midlife crisis, and I've met a lot of lawyers who hit a certain age and say, gee, do I want to be a lawyer the rest of my life? And they start looking for other professions, sometimes.
Yeah.
Writing.
Yeah, 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 and some successfully. It's a grueling profession. I mean, these folks work sometimes. I mean, I have a character in the book who actually works 27 hours in one day. He does this by working 24 hours, getting on a plane, and then going to California where the case is set. So the clock is sort of reset So he gets 3 additional hours, and by working through the whole day, he gets 27 hours in a day. So these are hardworking people, and I can imagine that there arrives a certain point in time where you wonder if you want to give yourself entirely up to work.
Well, work is a large part of Tim's identity, but he's also very involved with his family. And one of the interesting parts of the book is how his disease affects his family.
Yeah, I think it was very important for me to give voice to his wife and his daughter. They have perspectives that can't be avoided when something of this magnitude happens to somebody that you love. One is very supportive, although somewhat sacrificing of herself and wondering to what extent she needs to be sacrificing. And the daughter, I think, puts pressure on whether or not he's just sort of her father's kind of a loony.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have different perspectives from which they come at him, but they arrive also at a certain understanding at a certain point.
Well, Tim has no choice but to suffer the consequences of his disease, but Jane, his wife, does. His daughter has fewer options.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that what's difficult for Jane is that she has the freedom that Tim doesn't. Tim is forced to walk by his disease, is forced to walk by his body. Jane can walk out. She has the freedom to do that. And the question always pressing upon her is, to what extent do I sacrifice my life in order to keep the man that I'm married to safe and healthy and happy? And it's a constant struggle for her.
If the sexes were reversed here, if she's the one who had the disease, do you think that most men would have remained as dedicated?
I know of an individual who I think I had in the back of my mind who, I don't know many details, but I do know that he has been an enormously loyal husband over the course of a long illness with his wife. And I would like to think that the breakdown in sexes would be about even. I'd like to think.
Yeah. Well, many people Maybe. Judge Newt Gingrich harshly when he told his wife, who was in the hospital with cancer, that he was leaving her at that time. It does happen.
Yeah, he didn't have the best timing.
But there is that whole issue of the marriage vows in sickness and in health.
That's right.
And a lot of people really do consider that when things go rough.
I think so. I mean, if you make very few commitments in life, and if there's one that sticks out, it would be that one. I mean, it's a lonely haul without someone giving you that type of support.
Especially, and then there's the sexual aspect of marriage.
It's something that they have to face, because walking and walking and walking and then collapsing from exhaustion doesn't exactly leave him a lot of libido. So he has to sort of recognize that this too is a compromise that the disease has forced upon him. But you know, they get it on in the book a couple times.
I don't know how much to reveal about what happens with Becca, their daughter, and her desires, her attempts to keep her weight in check, or what happens with Jane as a result here. How much are you willing to talk about it?
It's a difficult question because, you know, of course, you write the book.
I don't want my audience to pretty much know this is not a book report here.
Yeah, right. No, it's not a book report. And I think that it's kind of important to leave some things, untold. But I think that what we can say is that they struggle in equal ways as Tim does. And they do it in very unique ways, in their own unique ways. But I think, as I was writing it, it's fair to say that each character, Tim included, had to have a grace note of some kind. Otherwise, the book ultimately would have been too bleak for me, and certainly for readers, I think.
Well, the disease does help him find some kind of common ground with Becca, his daughter.
Yes.
But Tim is working on a murder trial for a man who he believes is innocent when he's struck with the disease, and the defendant becomes another victim of the disease, doesn't he?
That's correct. One of the interesting things I found between the two professions, law and medicine, obviously Tim is trying to come up with an answer for his disease, and his client is trying to come up with an innocent verdict for his case. They're not quite as black and white as that. It requires a great deal of refinement and sensibility to try to determine whether or not somebody's innocent or what the disease is that somebody's suffering from. So there was a lot of thematic analogies between those two. Tim ultimately has to walk out on his client, and it creates a great deal of guilt, I think.
Even though this book doesn't have a lot in common with Then We Came to the End, I'm reminded that Then We Came to the End ends with everybody taking antidepressive medication.
I think a few do, yeah. I'm not sure everybody does, but everybody.
Well, it seemed like everyone did.
Well, they might have all needed it. I'm not sure they all did, but they might have all needed it.
So I'm wondering if you think that life itself is the cause of psychiatric problems.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, how can it not be? I mean, I sometimes look at my son. I have a newborn son, and along with all the joy and sort of natural pleasure that that bringing someone into the world accompanies, you also have to think that, you know, in a way, he's going to be an old man one day. You know, I mean, I see him and I think I've brought him into the world, and in some strange way, I've also caused him a great deal of heartbreak by doing so. I think that's okay. I think ultimately these are good problems to have because you're alive and you're experiencing all the felicities that life has to offer. But it's not unalloyed. You know, I had a friend recently say to me, I think it's very important to say yes to life, but with severe reservations. And I thought that was a wise thing to say. It was in a long, rambling conversation. And I think that's appropriate.
Joshua Ferris will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on the Upper West Side. That's at Broadway at 82nd Street. His novel, The Unnamed, is published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Lynn. It was a pleasure.